we are Oxford Society for International Development, and thank you for tuning in. My name is Hannah Brock, and today I'm honoured to be joined by Kolbasia Halsu MBE, the co-founder of Survivors Speak Out. SSO is a national network of torture survivors who are former clients of the charity Freedom from Torture. They speak with authority on issues of torture and life in the UK as asylum seekers and refugees who have survived trauma. A survivor himself, Kolbasia's story is an incredible one of courage and activism. Defying the intentions of his torturers to silence him, he uses his voice to help influence policy regarding issues surrounding torture, and his work is truly inspiring. Alongside public speeches at UN committees and in the UK Parliament, Kolbasia also runs his own YouTube channel full of inspirational and motivational content. More on that later. Kolbasia, thank you so much for your time. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm really honored to be here. And also, I'm really flattered by the introduction. Yeah.
Totally deserved. Could I please ask you to begin by talking to us a little about the meaning behind the term survivor and give a bit more of an introduction to the work SSO does and your inspiration for setting up the organization? Also, if you want to introduce your YouTube channel too, feel free.
Thank you. I think, honestly speaking, I think that's the first time. I've done quite a lot of interviews on radio, TV, and also I think some podcasts, but that's really the first time that someone asked me a question about what survivor mean. Really, honestly, yeah. I think it's a very good question, because how I define, you know, survivor, that's from my perspective and from the experience that, you know, I had. Is, you know, after as a torture, you go through stages, and because straight away after torture, you know, sometimes you lose your identity, as the identity that you were, and also I think you lose certain bit of what make you as a human being, you know, as such. You lose some trust, faith to people, you know, you find you're very afraid, you're scared, and you isolate yourself, and all those things that define you, you know, as such. And one thing that is really, really important, I think that's the reason behind some of the torture, is your voice. You lose your voice. And by losing your voice, you lose the power that you have. And you start, you know, living a life where you allow everybody else to make a decision for you. You seek help for everything and also for nothing. For me, that is the mind that I had when I was feeling, and that's the moment where I felt as a victim rather than a survivor. Because everything depends on other people. If I don't feel well, it depends on other people to make me to feel good or not. So, you know, that's why you go through therapy. So I went through therapy at Freedom from Torture to understand really what's going on. Because I was like, what's going on with my mind? Because I felt that I was strong. I'm a strong person. I believe in myself. And I lost all of them. So going through a rehabilitation at Freedom from Torture, there's a moment where, basically toward the end of my rehabilitation, what I did ask myself questions. The first question I did ask myself, who am I? Why I am this? Why I'm not the other person? And then I start looking around, and then I felt that I relinquish my power in the hand of everybody to make a decision for me. And I relinquish also my voice for other people to speak for me. Even in a therapy setting at that moment, because I'm not speaking English, honestly, I had a feeling in me that if my interpreter just answer the question that I'm being asked, if she can just answer those questions, I don't have to, because I said, you know much about my life by now. Why not just answer the question? You see, that's a certain vulnerability, and also the loss of the power, the loss of self-belief and self-confidence that I had in myself. And then I just thought, why I have not be able kind of to speak for myself? Why I have a voice? And I have seen challenges. I felt that, you know, I can say something where nobody else could say because they have not been through it. And, you know, that's the moment where it started clicking in my head that actually I've been living as a victim. And then when I start using my voice, then I start telling the story that I want to tell, not the story that people want me to tell. And at that moment where I think that, right, that I felt that I am acting as a survivor rather than a victim. And I start doing the thing where in the past I would rely on other people to do it. I start making my own decision. If somebody making a decision for me, I don't like it, I said to them, no, I don't like the way that you're making that decision. It doesn't suit me, it doesn't fit my need, and that's not my need, and so and so. That's how I define, you know, those two categories. And the vulnerability, you know, after torture can be different. You know, some people, you know, it takes them long time to come up, you know, to address the issue that, you know, they're facing. For other people, it takes lesser. But at the end, you build a certain resilience. And that's the resilience that you build. That's the resilience that will give you the power to say, no, I'm not a victim, I am a survivor. And when you decide that you are a survivor, I think, you know, you're able to achieve quite a lot of things. And touching on that, why I have, you know, decided to come up with the idea of the Sort of Speaker Network, right? I mean, I am expert. I did not go to school to study, but I'm expert by the experience. I see that, you know, a lot of the good organizations out there want to help people that in my position. But the thing that is missing is the other side of the coin. Because I think, you know, organizations have procedures, have policies, have those kind of things where it's based on empirical study, research, and those kind of things. But the thing that's missing now is the lived experience to tell you, right, so, you know, that's why you think about this way, but in reality, that's how I face it. And if you turn it this way, that's how we'll address my need. And that's the moment where I thought about that. And also I thought that, you know, for example, the asylum system as a general is based on policies. And those policies are put together without understanding exactly what is the impact that the system have on people that are going through it. And I said, you know, I have gone through it. I have been through the asylum. I have been through detention, you know, immigration detentions, and I have been through rehabilitation. I faced a problem and all those kind of things. I felt that, you know, I have something to share. Then so I brought other people with like-minded. Let's try to improve the situation of other people that will be coming after us. I think we'll improve it. We are not going to benefit from it. That's why, but let improve it for other people who will be coming. So that's how, you know, I come with the Survivor Speaker Network. But, you know, the YouTube, I really believe, honestly, I believe on human being as such that, you know, you have within yourself a power to behave or to be who you wish really to be. And that's the power is within. But the thing that's really stopping us, self-confident, no believing in ourselves, and no understanding how to dig deep, kind of to bring out the best of yourself. That's the thing that is really stopping people to achieve great things. We all go through adversity. There's no human being in this planet that has not gone through adversity. The adversity can differ from people. There are some of them that are lesser, the other, you know, like big. But for that person, the adversity is bigger, like the entire, you know, world that is collapsing on that person. And for me, how I can, you know, share with people that, you know, yes, you go through adversity, but has an end. And the end is that if you're willing to get through that mud, you're gonna come up stronger the other side, you'll build resilience. So that's why I use my YouTube channel to really help other people to see the power that they have within themselves.
I think it brings me great hope that someone like yourself, a survivor, has such a positive outlook on humanity. I think often we can get really bogged down in either personal struggles or a global struggle, and it's really hard to get out of that mindset. So I'm very hopeful that you have this outlook on humanity. I think you've already mentioned some things, both kind of personal and also structural, in terms of your experience with SSO. So the next question I wanted to ask you about is your experience with SSO in influencing policy, as well as some aspects about being part of SSO that might be personally difficult for the survivors involved. What are the challenges you've faced, and how have you tried to overcome them?
Yeah. When we really started with the idea of the Sword Speaker Network, I did not imagine that it will be as powerful as it is today. In March 3rd of this, or 2020, this year, I was at the Buckingham Palace, you know, when I was receiving the MBE from the Queen. That's a moment where I really, little bit understanding, you know, the impact of the Survivor Speaker Network. I was thinking about me. I was absolutely nobody. I was homeless. I didn't have country. I was absolutely nobody. And, you know, today I am here not just taking that, you know, honor for myself, but also for all the other torture survivors who come through freedom from torture, you know, all the asylum seekers and the refugees that, you know, coming through the United Kingdom to seek protection. When I was locked in the immigration detention center, it's like a half-half. 50% I could be deported back and go and then face, you know, torture again. And 50% I will be have a chance to remain in this country and given protection and start a new life. Luckily for me, I was given that. So the challenge in the beginning is really to make a name for the Survivor Speaker Network. Because the model is revolutionary, and as well is not something that people are familiar with and comfortable with. Basically, you challenge a structure, you challenge a system in a place, you challenge a knowledge that's been based for many, many years. You come telling them that basically, I know certain things where you don't know, and you need that. And also, you know, the personal challenge as somebody that, you know, seeking protection and also survivors is, because one thing that torture does to you is to silence you. That's why they torture you. They don't want you to speak. And now I'm completely doing something that opposite to what I am, you know, the trauma message sent me to do. Beside that, I am putting myself at the risk. Risk not just for me personally, also risk for my family, because I still have family, you know, back there. And if I speak against any powerful government, they can get to hurt my loved one, my family, and those kind of thing. And I was thinking about that. I was thinking of how I'm going to do that by keeping safe and also push you really forward, because I believe that, you know, I need to speak out. And how I'm going to do it and keeping safe, and also how I can make sure that, you know, other people that part of the network members also have that idea that what we are doing is also dangerous. But regardless of that, how can we keep safe? How can we keep our family safe? How can we do that? That's why we start thinking about just do it anonymously. You know, you don't show your face, you don't share your name. Every time that we're gonna looking to influence a policy, we do brainstorming, we do how you call it, like a focus group, to get all the different experiences together and then come up with recommendation. And that's something where people from different experiences bringing together, and some people said, I can be part of that. When we do those focus group, no one sees us, no one hears us, we do. And then we come up with a collective voice. And that's collective voice, you know, Kolbase, if you are happy, so you represent our voice. So that's how, you know, we set up to make it as easy, as simple, and as possible. And also, I think the other point, no one is proud to be called torture survivors or torture victim. No one is proud to be called asylum seeker or refugees. All those you know, labels have stigma attached to it and have shame attached to it and all those sort of things. And, you know, sometimes you struggle with that. When you say, you know, people see you and, you know, people want to distance themselves from you. And also sometimes it's very difficult in the community that we're living to also publicly say that, you know, you're a refugee or you're asylum. And sometimes, you know, people, basically I think people don't like people that look different or sound different, you know, from them. So I think people become so aggressive and, you know, sometimes, you know, using, you know, nice words toward you and all those sort of things. So you try to balance all those things to make easy for you to start a new life and to live and so and so.
I think that's really fantastic to hear that SSO has made such a lot of progress. But as you also mentioned, there is still a long way to go. And I guess what I would like you to elaborate on, if you can, is just the most significant shortfalls and blind spots you see in our policy regarding asylum seekers and torture survivors, either nationally or internationally.
Yeah, I think one of the challenges that that's one of my key advocacy for forever is how to create the platform for people with lived experience to be part of decision making, not, you know, bringing people at the end, but from the beginning. When you think about any policies that you know that will benefit a group of people, you need to engage with those people from the moment where you're starting talking about the policy, from the inception of the policy. Not, you know, you invite people, you dress the table and then so, you know, you come eat and okay, tell me how the food tastes like. No, it's not like that. So you have to ask them from the beginning, all right, so, you know, what do you think that I need to put on my table for you to come and then, you know, enjoy it? So you ask them from the beginning. When you ask them from the beginning, the feedback that you're gonna get at the end is like, oh, that's great. So yeah, exactly, that's what I planned for it. That's what I like it, and that's what it is. So that's the thing where, whether that in the UK, whether that globally in my advocacy, that's always the thing that I kind of pushing forward. When you want to engage with people with lived experience, you need to create the space for them to engage. Don't say that, you know, we have it's called survivor-centered approach, where, you know, like they want to base everything around survivors, but they don't create the space for that to happen. You know, they console people just at the end to just tick a box that, yeah, we consulted, you know, survivors. That is a big matter that needs to be addressed. And the second point attached to that is that you see there's quite a few grassroots organizations led by people with lived experience and so. But the challenge that those people face is that they don't get funding because they're so small, it's sometimes very difficult for them. And also sometimes they don't know how to, you know, to raise funds. So, you know, they have a challenge, you know, to raise proper bid to raise funding because they go against big organization who have a team of people, you know, fundraising for them. So they face that challenge. And there is no structure or there's no funding specifically allocated for those grassroots organizations led by people with lived experience to bring changes for the bigger community, you know, as such. So I think for me, those two things, the problematic for me that need to be looked into, need to be addressed, you know, as such. And there's a lack in that.
Yeah, I think you're really right to point that out in terms of that being an issue in so many departments for governments, our government, and also governments around the world, no matter what system they're using, whether it's a democratic or an undemocratic system, the need to consult people who are being frontline affected by their policies should take more of a priority for sure. Looking more broadly, could you please give some examples or elaborate on the kinds of ways that the act of torture can play out in a society? And this might not just be, you know, one country, but also transnationally.
Yeah, thank you for this, you know, for this question. Even currently, you know, I'm working very hard to convince the UK not to introduce a new bill. I don't know if you're aware of that bill, but you know, the UK thinking for introducing, it's called the Overseas Operational Bill and something like that. I'm just going to explain it a little bit. And basically it's, after 5 years, any serviceman who represents Britain somewhere abroad, you know, coming home, if they torture people after 5 years, so you, no one can persecute them, you know, as such. And I see a massive, really massive problem with that, not just within the UK, but globally. Because what UK represent in a global fight or in a ban, absolute ban against torture, UK is one of the biggest players when it comes down to upholding the absolute, you know, human right as such. You can, you take, you know, Magna Carta, you, all those kind of things, which as a rock base of what, you know, the UN based on a lot of, you know, the UN declaration, all those kind of things. But most countries where, you know, torture happen, there's so much difficult for people to get justice. And also, sometimes it takes so long for someone to get justice. Because somebody, if the head of the state is torturing people, you cannot get anything. And when they are not in power anymore, it will take so long for the International Criminal Court, you know, to get the person around the table. Because some countries decided not to comply with that and so and so. But what basically with that bill, if that bill became a law, the message is going to send to all those, you know, countries is that if the United Kingdom decided to change the law to protect the servicemen when they go and then, you know, commit human rights abuse abroad, why we cannot change? Who's going to hold who accountable now when it comes down to act of torture? And also the other side is that for you as a survivor to start thinking about speaking out or trying to seek justice, it takes 5 years. It's like a baby step. 5 years is nothing. For some people, it takes 30 years before, you know, they start thinking about justice. Because what I said earlier on in the beginning about the state of being victim and being survivors, and those, and when you're a victim, seeking justice is not, maybe could not be priority for you. You try to sort other thing. The mandate that's going to give to those countries that if the United Kingdom accept torturing and after 5 years decriminalizing torture, why we cannot do that? And then, you know, the torture is going to be embedding in a judicial process. So that legally, they're going to make torture legal. People are going to torture people and no one is going to say anything about it. And that is how you can take from one small country, you want to do a good thing for the military, and the impact just going to go wide. On the top of what, you know, Donald Trump already saying about torture is, you know, Donald Trump, that's another different matter for Donald Trump torture work.
So can I just clarify that this new bill, if it's passed, will basically ensure that British servicemen can be prosecuted within the 5 years from when they returned, but after that period, they can no longer be prosecuted?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, the UK, in 2012, the then Foreign Secretary, Lord Hague, with Angelina Jolie, they launched that initiative. I think it's one of the wonderful initiatives, you know, as such. It's called Preventing Sexual Violence Initiative in Conflict. So basically, what the initiative does is to make sure that the sexual violence is a crime, right? Whether you commit it now or you commit it later or you cut up later is a crime. And initially, you know, in that bill, sexual violence is also included to that. And with the Foreign Office, I think the Foreign Office, the PSV, managed the Preventing Sexual Violence Initiative, managed to exclude, you know, the sexual violence out of that. But the one thing that's left still there is torture. And what part of, you know, the fight or the campaign that now we're launching with the Sua Speak Out Network is that at least the minimum out of that bill will be torture as well. Because we cannot accept as a group of torture survivors accept that the UK include a crime as heinous, as horrible as a torture part of that bill, saying that, you know, we're protecting our servicemen. I respect, you know, the servicemen, you know, they're sacrificing their life to make the world a better place. And for that, they're also responsible to uphold the highest standard possible for citizens, for vulnerable people not to be abused. And if they cannot do that, they don't have an honor to be in another country to uphold peace. Because if you have to uphold peace, you have to present yourself with dignity and with respect, and you respect the people that you come to give them the protection and the peace that is needed.
Yeah, I find that really shocking, and I do want to come back to Britain later, but also you mentioned America and Trump. And so in terms of international development, we've seen countries in positions of power, such as the US and China, both using torture themselves, as well as providing funding and support to countries, many of which openly use torture. I found this great quote of yours on the Freedom From Torture website, which reads, "As a torture survivor, you carry the physical and psychological damage for life. President Trump, I respect your commitment and promise to Americans to make America great again, but a great nation doesn't support or endorse the practice of torture. It respects human rights and upholds the absolute ban on torture." So how do you think the international community can act effectively in dealing with powerful countries, both using and endorsing torture?
Yeah. I think, you know, the disappointing side of the part of the international community is that they don't speak out. Friend or no friend, when Donald Trump make those kind of statements, the UK should stand up saying, absolutely, no. There's no civilized country like the United States. We as a United Kingdom, we cannot accept those kind of statements. And the whole international community need to stand up to say, no, absolutely, torture is wrong. Regardless of what torture is wrong, and we cannot support that. But they don't do that. And as long as they don't do that, they don't stand against him saying that, you know, certainly, Mr. President, what you're saying is problematic. We cannot accept that. Who's just going to say it? He's just going to keep doing it. And then he's going to inspire people like, you know, what is his name, you know, the Brazilian president.
Oh, Bolsonaro.
Yeah, he's just going to inspire Bolsonaro. And no one can say to China anything. Who can say to China, why are you torturing people? Why are you financing people that countries are torturing? Who's going to hold them accountable? Before, the United States was, they called themselves the free world, right? The United States, for a very long time, played a role of like the savior of the world. When there's a problem, they want to go there and then just save people and so and so. And for a very long time, people regarded the United States, you know, as such, as like, if there's a problem, they're going to go there and, you know, just try to resolve the problem. But nowadays, they're just creating problems everywhere. And oof, you know, Donald Trump, he's just a character.
I think that's putting it very lightly. But that does lead really nicely onto my final question, because in recent years we've seen a lot of political shift in the West towards more populist leaders. And I wanted to end by asking about what you see in our future. Do you think the effect of Brexit and the changing attitudes towards immigration will consequently affect Britain's attitude towards asylum seeking, given that many asylum seekers are fleeing war zones and countries in which British foreign policy has often had a significantly negative impact, even if they were well-intentioned? Do you think we have a particular duty to asylum seekers?
Honestly, I didn't, you know, before coming to Britain, I didn't know much about Britain as such, apart from, you know, the textbook, history, and also, you know, the World War II, and, you know, the role that the Britain has played in standing up against Hitler and, you know, starting, you know, the process of finally kind of at the end defeating, you know, the fascist men, defeating, you know, Hitler and all those sort of things. I had a really great respect, you know, to Britain, you know, such. Let's not talk about, like the British Empire and all those sort of things. I think, you know, that's another matter. But, you know, I had great respect for that. And when I came here, I was taken aback by the treatment that I received through the asylum, you know, through the asylum system. And, you know, the unwelcoming attitude that, you know, people had, at that time. I must say that, you know, the Home Office, because we're working with the Swart Speaker Network, you know, closely with the Home Office, and they're really taking into consideration incorporating our experience of the asylum, and, you know, they're looking really how to improve that. But there's a culture there that need to be changed, need to be broken, and that's, it would take a little bit longer. But frankly speaking, I think, you know, we need to give them little credit for the Home Office staff there, that, you know, they're trying their best. But most of British people, they're really compassionate people, frankly speaking. Britain is one of the countries where you find quite a lot of charities. You can find charity for almost every issue that is out there, right? Every issue that out there, you find charity. Someone thought about it, I need to do something about it. And that is British for me. That is British. British is having the door open for somebody that need help, come and then find the help. Somebody that need water, you know, we give them water. That's what, you know, British, you know, for me. And with the rise of, you know, the populism, people find it so simple and easy just to blame the issue that is caused by bad politicians on poor people, vulnerable people, such as, you know, asylum seekers and all those other people that fleeing for their life to get somewhere where they can start. When your life in danger, regardless of what your country is, when you know that your life in danger, you're not gonna run. So that is a natural to a human being, the survival instinct. When your life is in danger, you run to save your life. That's instinct. And that's why we asylum seekers also use, when you see that your life in danger, you run, you go find a cover. And if the cover does end to be Britain, so that's what it is. But to say that, you know, those people are cause of unemployment, they come here to take our benefit, and, you know, by, what is his name, Nigel?
Farage.
Yes, exactly. Every time when I think about Brexit, I just think about, you know, that image of Nigel Farage, you know, the big poster that have a line, queue of people coming. So all those people coming, you know, coming to Britain. And people even not understanding the difference between the EU system of the migration and the movement, people not understanding, for them is asylum. For them is everybody is just together. And, you know, we need to take control of our border, you know, those kind of languages. And since the Brexit, you know, the level of racism against other people has just skyrocketed. And it's up to us to change that. And we have a power to change that. No politicians. Politicians, all what they want vote. Because if they feel that, you know, being against immigration, if that's what's going to bring them the vote, then, you know, that's what they're going to go through. If there's something else that's going to bring them the vote, then that's what they're going to be. It's a politician is, you know, they're just, it's a magnet.
It's a metronome, right?
Yeah, metronome, exactly. So that's what it is. The politicians as a metronome, you know, they just balance wherever they feel that, you know, going to give them vote. But we, as a, you know, citizen, as a people, we are the one that can change that. We are the one that can welcome people, because we are the one that live with those people together. We are the one that do everything that we can to support those people. And as long that we believe that we have a heart to welcome people, regardless of how they look like or how they sound like or what is their accent, I think Britain's going to be in a good hand, because politicians cannot dictate the way that we need to behave to one another.
What a wonderful note to end on. Well, Kilbasia, thank you so much for joining us on our podcast today. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, and I feel very grateful and inspired by all the work that you're doing.
Thank you very much. I really did enjoy that chat, honestly. Thank you very much, and thank you.
For our listeners who have felt inspired by this podcast and want to get involved with the charity Freedom from Torture and support SSO, we've attached a link to their main website in our description. Especially to all the university students out there supporting local branches such as the one in Oxford, as well as raising awareness through putting on university events and fundraisers, is a great way to begin. You can find the link to Kilbasia's brilliant YouTube channel, full of inspirational and motivational videos, in our description box, alongside our own website for anyone interested in finding out a little more about who we are and what we do. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and if you have any feedback, do get in touch. We'd love to hear. This has been Hannah Brock for Oxid. We hope you'll join us for more next time. This episode was edited and produced by Hannah Brock with the help of Mia Simovich, music by Lorcan Cutlip Cook.